All right, Erev Tov. Welcome to the Presidents and the Jews, Part 2, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib, and tonight we discuss John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, a doubleheader. So the second and third presidents spent much of their life feuding, sometimes bitterly, and even not talking to each other for years. They're very different temperaments and backgrounds and even thoughts on government. Adams was a New Englander from Massachusetts, and that shaped his worldview. Adams was a lawyer by training. He wasn't a fighter, but he could be very feisty. And until very recently, he was perceived as a lesser figure among the founders, and certainly not as charismatic as Jefferson, who was a Virginian, a Renaissance man, a person of enormous talents, and a prodigious range of interests, of politics, science, architecture, philosophy, literature, etc. Jefferson's achievements were summed up by one of John Kennedy's most famous quips. He had invited all of America's living Nobel laureates to the White House for dinner, and he mused, "I think this is the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge, that has ever been gathered at the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." Now, it was because Jefferson had such a wide range of interests, it's, by today's standards, unimaginable. Many of the founders did not get along. It's bound to happen with great people. Maybe the greatness of the American Constitution and the reason for its endurance, such as it has endured, was because it was built on compromise, on give and take, and trying to build consensus on issues that seemed intractable, slavery being just one of them. But each individual brought a unique dimension to the formation of the United States, and each contributed, perhaps without fully knowing it, to the development of the American Jewish experience in America as well. And each of them had to deal with America's first entanglement in the Arab Middle East. That's gone on for a long time now. So John Adams was born in Quincy, Massachusetts, 1735, as part of Greater Boston, just 3 years after George Washington, but Adams outlived Washington by more than a quarter century. So he was the first vice president of the United States, the second president, the first president to be defeated for a second term. And if you think about it, there haven't been that many. After Adams, it was just Hoover, and then Carter, and then George Bush the first. Almost every other president who runs for a second term wins. Like Bush the first, Adams was the first president whose son also became president. So that's vindication of sorts. John Quincy Adams, number six. And Adams has had a recent revival the last decade or so. A book that I relied on extensively, I read years ago, I read it again last week, Biography of John Adams by David McCullough, the famous historian, as well as the epitome of renown in the world today, his own cable miniseries on HBO, John Adams. And that's really solidified his reputation among the founders, but he suffered for much of his life by comparison to others, and especially George Washington. In a word, Adams was everything that George Washington was not, and that's not meant as a compliment. Washington was tactful and dignified. Adams was irascible and tempestuous. James Madison later wrote that Washington was cool, considerate, and cautious, while Adams was, I quote, headlong and kindled into flame by every spark that lights on his passions. Washington was tall and muscular and eye candy for the ladies. Adams was short, plump, and funny looking, with a hairstyle later made famous by Larry Fine, the non-Howard among the Three Stooges. Now, in truth, you get all sorts of references here. Hope you keep up. So in truth, Washington was not close to either Adams or Jefferson, and he actually despised Jefferson, whom he would have fired as his Secretary of State had Jefferson not had the good sense to resign first. But Adams, we'll start with him, was probably the most unsung of the founders, one whose contributions were indispensable in discreet ways, both politically and diplomatically. And it's interesting that neither Adams nor Jefferson fought in the Revolution. Even though they were of age to fight, Adams spent much of the time overseas, and Jefferson basically in hiding. He sat it out in Virginia. Adams married well. Married a 19-year-old Abigail Smith. He was 9 years older than her. Her grandfather was the Quincy, after which the town of Quincy was named, where Adams was born. And so that's the name they gave to their son as well, their oldest son, John Quincy Adams. She was a catalyst in his life, and she pushed him and encouraged him and endured much hardship in their married lives. We'll get back to it later, but they spent well over a decade apart from each other because he was posted to Europe, and she rarely left their farm in Braintree. So even when he was domestic, say in the local continental business, he lived in Philadelphia for months at a time, and she almost never accompanied him, preferring to stay home. Because of their separations and their personalities, there's a substantial record of correspondence between the two. It seemed that they wrote each other almost every day they were apart. Adams himself said, "I have three loves in life, my farm, my family, and my goose quill." He didn't really write books. He wrote letters constantly. Abigail wrote to John at a certain point, "You cannot be, I know, nor do I wish to see you, an inactive spectator," as she encouraged him to participate in the drama of the day. "We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them." That duality of high-sounding words and too few actions is something that we're accustomed to today in politics, not to mention the rabbinate, but that's for a different time. He always addressed her in letters as "dearest friend," or "my best, dearest, wisest, worthiest friend in the world." And to her, he was the tenderest of husbands. That's how she would address him. And they had a real love story. You don't always have that, but they actually did. Adams was a farmer, a lawyer by training. He was a Harvard man. He wrote that the typical breakfast at Harvard was beer and bread. I don't think that's changed. And Adams practiced law for many years as he tended his farm. He was extremely well-read. They said of Adams, he could discourse on any subject for too long. And he was a devout Christian. He was one of the few devout Christians among the major founders. His father was a deacon. His mother, in fact, wanted him to be in the ministry. Later in life, he became a Unitarian as he diverged from standard Christian doctrine. He didn't believe in the divinity of Jesus, nor did Jefferson, for that matter. Jefferson was an admitted deist. He believed in God as the creator, but not the Bible. And he did not believe God was active in human affairs. In terms we would understand, he believed in the God of Yotza HaMa'oros, but not the God of Habokh HaBam Yisrael B'Yavo, the first bracha before Kriyat Shema, and not the second. We'll see later that Adams was what we call today a Christian Zionist. And Adams also was a brutally honest individual, not always a winning trait in a politician or any person for that matter. A friend said of Adams, he was a stranger to dissimulation, meaning he had no guile, no artifice, no fakery. He would tell it like it was and tell it to your face also. Adams was drawn to politics in his 20s, and he sensed that America would be independent of Britain. In his 20s means it was already the 1750s, about 20 years before independence. And he wrote then, "All that part of creation that lies within our observation is liable to change. Even mighty states and kingdoms are not exempted." And he specifically mentioned Imperial Rome and others as well. So the fact the British Empire was very powerful, with a powerful navy, did not mean to Adams that American independence would be a hopeless quest. And he saw himself destined for greatness, which is sometimes a sign of mental illness, but otherwise it's an inspiration to talented people. They don't want to be held down. Adams said, I quote, "Reputation ought to be the perpetual subject of my thoughts and the aim of my behavior." And by reputation he meant what he would accomplish in the world, in the greater world. He said this first about being a lawyer, but he sought a grander stage as well. And so Adams became one of the strongest proponents of independence, and he inserted himself first in local politics and then into the continental leadership in order to protect New England from the ravages of the British. And he was galvanized when Thomas Paine published anonymously Common Sense, a pamphlet in early 1776. The sentiments were noble. Paine was an Englishman. Although Paine's attack on the idea of hereditary monarchy contained this nugget, Paine writes in Common Sense, "Monarchy is one of the sins of the Jews." It's always our fault. From biblical times, because we show the world what a monarchy means, and the fact is, not every king of Israel was a tzaddik also. But from that, Adams dissented, and then, as he scrutinized Common Sense a little more, he said that the pamphlet contained no way forward, no program, no guidance, and he told his wife that the author has a better hand at pulling down than building. Adams would build. So Adams worked closely with Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin on the Declaration of Independence in June of that year, 1776. So everybody admits that the first draft was Jefferson's, and the tone was really Jefferson's as well. Jefferson grew bitter, as always happens. Anyone ever tries to draft for some organization a policy statement, the mission statement, the resolution, etc., different people whittled away at his language, and he just walked away at a certain point. He couldn't take it. And you could see the various changes in the texts. All were preserved. Jefferson originally wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and inviolable." And that was changed, and probably for the better, to "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," etc. When Congress met on July 1st, and there are other changes as well. When Congress met on July 1st to discuss the actual Declaration of Independence, that they all knew would provoke a war with Britain, it was Adams, by Thomas Jefferson's own admission, who spoke eloquently and passionately, swaying the delegates. Jefferson wrote, "Adams' power of thought and expression moved us from our seats." And Adams himself said, he wrote his speech later, "We are in the very midst of a revolution, the most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of the world. And the product of that revolution indeed justified what he said." It's interesting, Adams spoke with a lisp, a very heavy lisp. He had no teeth by the time of the Continental Congress, but that did not detract from the power of his oratory, and his words carried the day. Independence was approved unanimously, there were dissenters, but they graciously absented themselves from the hall so the vote should be unanimous. And America was born July 4th, 1776. Both Adams and Jefferson would sidestep the slavery question. Adams opposed it. He called it a foul contagion in the human character. But he could do nothing about it, and the founders realized they would not have a nation if they had to write off the South. And notwithstanding that Jefferson owned several hundred slaves, they both added anti-slavery verbiage to the Declaration, which was removed by others. And it ended, again, with a religious sentiment, with firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, and then they stated what they were going to state. Just 2 years later, 1778, Adams was sent on a diplomatic mission to France and other European countries to round up support and especially financing. And he would spend most of the war there and most of the 1780s in Europe as well, representing the new United States in France, in the Netherlands, even becoming the first representative to George III in Britain, with Abigail joining him for the first time only in 1785. So Adams was instrumental in negotiating the Paris Peace Treaty in 1783, but if you think about it, by the time he returned to the U.S. in 1788, he'd been away for 8 consecutive years, and he missed his 2 youngest sons growing up. John Quincy was with them, serving as a secretary. He was in his early 20s at the time, but he had sons who were 7 and 10 when he left, and 15 and 18 when he returned. That's a long absence. That's a real sacrifice. John Quincy Adams, though, gained valuable experience serving as his father's secretary. Paris in the 1780s was a remarkable place. If only for that, you had three of the giants of the Revolution all there at the same time: Adams, Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. In Paris in the 1780s, Adams grew to dislike Franklin intensely. For similar reasons, Franklin, he felt, was a bit of a libertine, was not especially hardworking. Franklin never rose before 10 o'clock, and he resented Franklin's popularity with the French. Dr. Franklin, Dr. Franklin, and especially his popularity with the ladies. Adams was very loyal. Franklin was not married. Adams wrote at the time, and he referred to Franklin, and this is good Musser, of the lost virtue of modesty. He said, modesty is a virtue that can never thrive in public. And listen to what he had to say, because it's something that we just live with today in the reverse. He said he's disappointed, this is the 1780s, how a man must be his own trumpeter, write his own praise in the newspapers, have a retinue, have his picture drawn and his statue made, and perpetuate his fame. It just didn't sit well with him. It was against his personality, but that good Musser made him a flawed politician, because a politician has to do all those things, unfortunately. And Adams said, popularity was never my mistress, nor was I ever, or shall I ever be, a popular man. And that he had right. So he returned to the U.S. in 1788, and he became the natural choice for vice president. If only because he's been away so long, they had no dirt on him. But the real reason was that Washington was from the South, and they needed a northerner to balance the ticket, make everybody happy. So they put Adams in, but people did recognize Adams' unique contribution, and of course he was deeply involved in the Constitutional Convention. So Washington was voted unanimously, and Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, ensured that, arousing the ire of Adams, he made sure Washington got every electoral vote. So a second vote then had to be held to see who'd be the vice president, and Adams won that vote with 34 votes, meaning less than half. 10 candidates ran, less than half, and he felt humiliated by it. Now, they were sworn in together. I should have mentioned it last week, because it has resonance later on throughout American history. The Constitution prescribes the precise formula for the oath of office a president takes, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 8. I do solemnly swear, I faithfully execute the office of president of the United States, and will do the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And Washington added, so help me God. He was one who added those four words that every president has used since then, and Adams approved as well. Adams settled into the vice presidency miserably, setting the tone for all others. He hated it. And Washington began the tradition of keeping the vice president in the shadows. And Adams called it the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived. And he said in brief once on the Senate floor, I am vice president. In this, I am nothing, but I may be everything, and therein lies the dilemma. It was as vice president that his feud with Jefferson began over doctrine. I mentioned last week, one of the great apprehensions in the early years of independence was in creating or against creating a monarchy. So we can't really appreciate it today, but the founders took it very seriously. They lived in a world of only monarchies. So the Constitution in Article 1, Section 9 says, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. Congress has no right to declare someone a knight, a duke, a lord, or this or that against nobility. But nonetheless, the culture of the times was to have these things, to have a royalty. Adams, I mentioned last week, did support royal-sounding titles for the leadership. Even His Majesty, or His Highness, was rejected. So he was suspected of harboring monarchical sentiments. And that is how the political parties developed. Washington ran without a party. So this dispute between those who favored a strong federal government and those who didn't was finessed at the Constitutional Convention, but it blossomed in the 1790s. Adams was a Federalist, supporting a strong federal government. Jefferson was an anti-federalist looking to protect states' rights and prerogatives. If this dispute sounds familiar, it should. It was a raging argument in the decades before between Hobbes and Locke, but it really continues until today. Paine, Thomas Paine, who was an anti-federalist, said one of his most famous quotes, "That government is best which governs least." Where do we hear that? Ronald Reagan would say it all the time. The government is best when it governs least. So Adams was a Federalist. He wanted a strong federal government. Jefferson was an anti-Federalist. And in 1796, they ran against each other for president. Jefferson with the oddly named Democratic Republican Party. It's a different world then. And Adams represented the Federalist Party. Adams won 71-68 in the electoral vote. But by law, Jefferson, the loser, became his vice president. And they continued to clash until they were no longer on speaking terms. That's when they changed it, that you'd have two people run, president and vice president, against another pair, and that pair would serve together. Adams, as president, would lose re-election in 1800 to Jefferson. Adams skipped town the night before the inauguration, so he shouldn't have to see it. And the issues he dealt with as president would make the election of 1800 the first in which the Jewish vote was courted. There weren't that many Jews, there were 3,000, but there was a disproportionate number of Jews living, where do you think? New York. Jews, of course, were always suspicious of monarchies and not fully convinced, how could we be, that America would be different than Europe. So, for example, I alluded to it last week, many states still required religious tests for a person to serve in office, even for a person to vote. Religious tests meaning you had to take an oath declaring a belief in Christianity or some other doctrine, even to vote. The U.S. Constitution banned religious tests, but it didn't apply to the states, meaning for federal office you couldn't have such a requirement, but the states still had it. Over time, the original 13 states came around, the last being Maryland in 1828, which passed a special law for Jews, allowing Jews to declare a belief in Olam Haba, what they called a future state of rewards and punishment, as opposed to stating a belief in Christianity. Because that meant they weren't heathens, or we weren't heathens. Heathens still were a problem. But they formulated a different oath for Jews. And even New York didn't come around until the middle of the second decade of the 18th century. So Adams frightened Jews, because he, although he was against the monarchy, strong federal governments, the truth is, it's a mixed blessing. If the government is made up of virtuous people, so then it's a good thing. If not, then it's a catastrophe. So this is what happened that frightened Jews even more. As war broke out between Britain and France in 1793 in the wake of the French Revolution, and the U.S. chose sides in that war. Adams supported the British. His vice president, it was in 1793. Adams supported the British. Jefferson, the Secretary of State, supported the French. The French began seizing U.S. merchant ships. I should digress. If you saw today's Wall Street Journal, it was a book review of a book on this period of time. And when this war broke out between Britain and France in 1793, the British began impressing any able-bodied male into their navy to fight the French, even Americans who were visiting. So one of the aspects of the book, whose name I don't recall, is how the early Americans tried to prove they were American and not British. They wouldn't have to fight in the British Navy. Well, while the British are capturing people for their Navy, the French are seizing American merchant ships, and when the U.S. protested, remember, this is all slow motion. You sent the letter, got there in 6 weeks or 8 weeks. The French demanded from the American diplomats a hefty bribe in order to negotiate a treaty with them. The money would go to Lord Talleyrand, who was the French foreign minister. This became public. The populace turned against France. Talleyrand was an amateur, by the way. He could have called what he was doing the Talleyrand Global Initiative, and then all the money coming into him would have been just for humanitarian purposes, and no one would have batted an eyelash. But when the populace turned against France, Adams was bolstered temporarily, and that helped Adams in 1796. Now, this was the famous XYZ affair that everyone studied in social studies, because Adams kept the names of the French diplomats anonymous. It was such a fear of war with France that Washington in 1797 was called out of retirement to again command the American forces. But it was in this environment that a South Carolina congressman, Robert Goodloe Harper, said, "Millions for defense, but not one cent for tribute." They're not going to pay the French in order that they should not seize American vessels. The country was split. There were threats of secession. States would leave and make their own nation. Congress passed, and Adams signed into law in 1798, the Alien and Sedition Acts, that did a number of things. It increased the residency requirement for new citizens from 5 to 14 years. Not good for Jews who were coming from overseas. And gave the president the right to imprison or detain aliens that the president on his own would deem dangerous to the peace and safety of the United States. And the Sedition Act also banned criticism of the government. Well, none of this sit well with Jews, obviously concerned. If you're going to keep immigrants out and give the president the right to detain aliens or prevent criticism of the government, all of that just too reminiscent of what was happening in Europe. So this featured prominently in the election of 1800, which the two men ran against each other. This time Jefferson ran, also a very close election. For the first time, as I noted, candidates from both parties ran on separate parties. The Jefferson ticket won 73-65, as opposed to 4 years earlier, it was 71-68. What was the switch? The decisive votes came from New York, which had a large Jewish population. Large, I mean, it's in the mid-hundreds, but not many people voting altogether. Remember, women didn't vote. You had to be a landowner to vote. So if you have even 500-600 votes overwhelmingly for one candidate, think New Square, so it helps in a person win. Aaron Burr became Jefferson's vice president, later shot Hamilton to death right outside of Jay's office. Now the sedition, although he wasn't a witness to it, the Sedition Act about banning criticism of the government, for example, that lapsed. Jefferson let it lapse once he took office, but the Alien Act remains in effect, that the president can deem an individual group a danger to the peace and safety of the U.S. That law is still in the books, and it was used against Japanese and German citizens of the United States during World War II, but Adams was gone from power. One of Jefferson's leading supporters who turned on Adams was a fellow we mentioned last week, a Jew named Benjamin Nones, a French Jew. He'd been a major on George Washington's staff. He was openly attacked in the Federalist newspaper as, I quote, "a Jew, a Republican, and poor." Now, he responded publicly that he was a Jew and proud of it, and a Republican and proud of it, saying this, and I quote, "I am a Jew, and if for no other reason, for that reason, I am a Republican." The last Jew to make such a statement for a good two centuries. And he said, "In republics, we have rights. In monarchies, we live but to experience wrongs. How then can a Jew but be a Republican?" That was Nonus. And he was defiant. Even when he was accused of being poor, he owned up to it also. Adams, for his part, was mostly without prejudice. He must have known Jews in New England, but he first came into regular social contact with Jews in Amsterdam, where he served as ambassador in the 1780s, and he wrote in liberal Holland, where the culture was tolerant and open-minded, he noticed that the Jews there were the most liberal and accommodating of all, and he struck up friendships with them. Adams shared Washington's insistence that America not be deemed a Christian nation, and it was in his later writings that Adam's feelings, his warm feelings towards Jews, were fully expressed. He wrote to Jefferson after they reconciled in 1812 and corresponded regularly. I quote, they were talking about the Jews in their writings back and forth, and Adam said, "I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize man than any other nation." It was a point that Adams had earlier articulated to a Dutch friend, a lawyer, when Adams was protesting Voltaire's very base, primitive Jew hatred. And Adams wrote, "If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing man." And he said, if he were an atheist who just believed in chance, then chance had, I quote, ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty, sovereign of the universe. And then he added, I cannot say that I love the Jews very much, nor the French, nor the English, nor the Romans, nor the Greeks. We must love all nations as well as we can, but it is very hard to love most of them. Adams was an equal opportunity misanthrope. Didn't like anybody. This last passage he wrote in a letter to Mordechai Manuel Noah, maybe the most famous Jew of that time, the first two decades of the 19th century. Mordechai Manuel Noah was the son of a Sephardi mother and Ashkenazi father who fought during the Revolutionary War. He was born in Philadelphia, raised in Charleston, orphaned at a young age. He entered politics almost at a very young age in South Carolina. Remember, there were no restrictions at all on Jews. And he became very prominent, more on him in the coming weeks, but he gave the dedication speech for the Mill Street Synagogue in New York City on May 28th, 1818, Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. He sent a copy of his speech to Adams. He sent the same copy to Madison as well. That's for next week. And he received this reply. Adams wrote to him, "I wish your nation may be admitted to all the privileges of citizens in every country in the world. This country has done much. I wish it may do more and annul every narrow idea in religion, government, and commerce." And a few years later, Adams wrote the most far-reaching statement of Jewish nationhood that would be uttered for almost a century. He wrote, "I really wish the Jews again in Judea an independent nation." Imagine that. Unfortunately, he added that if that happened, he hoped that, I quote, "no longer persecuted, they would soon wear away some of the asperities," it means the brusqueness and peculiarities of their character, "possibly in time become liberal Unitarian Christians," end quote. Brusque? Us? Who's he talking about? Jefferson was born in 1743 into material comfort. Jefferson had a rapacious mind, became a lawyer, philosopher, architect, inventor, farmer, scientist, horseman, violinist, etc. Adams saw him later as his protege, but Jefferson was too independent-minded for that. Jefferson never fought, as I mentioned. He spent the war years building his estate in Monticello. He was basically in hiding because known as the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, so he was a marked man. The British actually came and captured Monticello. Jefferson got word of it and fled to another estate. He was never caught, but in fact the British did not occupy Monticello. They did go to other estates of his and occupy it as well. He married a young widow, 23, distant cousin, Martha Wales, who bore him 6 children. Only 2 survived, and she herself died 1782 after just 10 years of marriage from complications from childbirth, and Jefferson never remarried. He fell into a depression and only snapped out of it when the government sent him to Paris, and he loved Paris. He returned from Paris in the fall of 1789 to discover that he had been appointed America's first Secretary of State. In every respect, Jefferson was anti-monarchy, and that too was a comfort to Jews. He was the first real plebeian in that sense. Notwithstanding, he was nobility, came from a wealthy family, etc. He was the first to walk to his inauguration. Think Jimmy Carter. Carter was just copying Jefferson, he wore a plain suit, not the fancy clothing the first two presidents had worn. He stopped the practice of presidents delivering the State of the Union address, which is mandated by the Constitution, in person to Congress, feeling it was too much like a speech from the throne. So for more than a century after Jefferson, the president sent a written message, written State of the Union address to Congress, and it was read by a clerk until Woodrow Wilson began delivering the speech again in person in 1913. What would we give today not to have a State of the Union address in Congress? All right, so the last president to send a written State of the Union address to Congress, it was Jimmy Carter in 1981, because he'd lost the election, his final days of office, so he didn't want to show up in Congress. But almost every president uses a major stage to present his views. Jefferson was a very successful president, 1801 to 1809, changed the face of America, primarily through the Louisiana Purchase, which he bought from Napoleon's France. They needed the money. Once America expanded and more than doubled the territory, Jews found places to go across the country. And Jews, you know, it was a time that Jews were sent first to Galveston in the late 19th century, and other times to the Midwest, and Jews went to the far west as well. Jefferson was low-key, informal, democratic with a small d, tolerant to a fault. He was diplomatic. He was soft-spoken, also the opposite of Adams. At the Congress that decided on independence, for which he'd written the Declaration, he said almost nothing. He just sat there listening. And he would later advise a grandson, also a good Mussar for all of us, "When I hear another express an opinion which is not mine, I say to myself, he has a right to his opinion as I to mine. Why should I question it? His error does me no injury. And shall I become Don Quixote to bring all men by force of argument to one opinion? Be a listener only. Keep within yourself and endeavor to establish with yourself the habit of silence, especially in politics." Very good Mussar. He hated public speaking so much, he gave exactly two public speeches while he was president, his inaugural addresses. One wishes modern presidents were as reticent, they might be thought wiser. Now, the great conflict in his life was slavery, because he was opposed morally and intellectually, but he owned slaves in reality, most of which he had inherited from his wife after she died. Now, there are rumors, persistent rumors, that he fathered children with a slave, Sally Hemings. Who am I to speculate? There is genetic evidence, there is oral evidence, but the truth is the DNA could be from a Jefferson brother, a Jefferson nephew, etc. And none of this is new. It was made this major scandal about 15, 20 years ago. None of it was new. It was first reported in the press in 1802 in the Richmond newspaper of James Callender, who was angry at Jefferson. He'd become a Federalist, this Callender. So this was already a media sensation while Jefferson was president. Headline in Callender's Richmond newspaper: "By this wench Sally, our president has had several children." Now, Callender had also exposed Hamilton's affair with a married woman in the mid-1790s, to whose husband, James Reynolds, Hamilton had to pay hush money, so he shouldn't be shamed. If nothing else, the founding fathers were busy beavers. On the other hand, we now know that Sally Hemings was Jefferson's wife's, Martha's, half-sister. His father-in-law had a relationship with Sally's mother, Elizabeth, and fathered several children with her. She was his slave also. So reports of the times indicate that Sally Hemings, being a half-sister, bore a striking resemblance to Jefferson's late wife, whom he adored. So that could explain also why they had a relationship. It wasn't just the master oppressing the slave, but it was more of a family bond, sisters. It's true that he freed from slavery all of her children. He took, in fact, Sally's brother with him to, took Sally also, but took Sally's brother James to Paris to be a chef in the 1780s. As it's also true that Jefferson grew to oppose slavery on moral grounds, but felt it was impractical to abolish. And it's also true, we have to say it, Jefferson was a licentious, libidinous, lascivious ladies' man, and it didn't matter to him whether the women were married or not. He just didn't care. And he wasn't married, so he just lived it up, whether in Paris or in America, for that matter. But, we'll say to his credit, Jefferson had the great merit of introducing French fries to the United States. He had enjoyed it so much in France, the years he spent there, that he served in the White House for the first time, 1802, and it became very popular. So again, Jefferson as president became the first president to appoint a Jew to a federal post. What's interesting about it is he did not necessarily know the man was Jewish. When war loomed with France in 1798, Reuben Edding from Maryland joined the army, became captain of the militia in Maryland. 4 years later, as a reward for that, Jefferson appointed Edding the U.S. Marshal for Maryland. I'll note again, that was a federal post. Under then Maryland law, Reuben Edding could not have held that post unless he took a Christian oath, being a Jew, but that was not the federal law. It doesn't seem that Jefferson had much contact with Jews in Virginia, but he did reach out to Jews explicitly in the 1800 campaign, and his religious tolerance came from a very unique place. I mentioned before he was a deist. He believed in God as creator. He believed in an afterlife. He was a churchgoer, even though he didn't believe in the Christian doctrine or... He wasn't a pious individual. He didn't believe in Jesus' divinity either. And he rejoiced that belief in one God was reviving in the young America. They hated Catholics also, by the way. And he expected the day, much like Adams, when all Americans would be Unitarians. Where did he see himself? In religious terms, as he said, of a sect by myself, as far as I know. I know Jews like that also, by the way. A sect to themselves. He actually knew very little about Judaism, and he just assumed that Jews lived as the Bible said they lived. He had no idea really what the Talmud was. He spoke of the Talmud without any understanding of what the Talmud was. But nonetheless, he was in that same tradition that made a stamp on American life of openness and religious tolerance. It was Jefferson who first brought America into the maelstrom of the Middle East. After the Revolution, Congress put the fledgling American Navy into mothballs, and from the mid-1780s on, the merchant vessels of the U.S. were subject to attacks in the Mediterranean by Muslim Arabs located on the northern African coast, Morocco, Algeria, Tunis, Tripoli, Libya. Vessels and crews were seized, and then held for ransom or blackmail, what they called tribute back in those days. Jefferson in the 1790s, as Secretary of State, investigated, because the Arabs were attacking any ship of any Christian nation, and he found out that the Europeans, then as now, a feckless bunch, were paying between $100,000 and $300,000 per year to the pirates representing those states on the North African coast, which was a lot of money then. Adams, as president, paid the money. It's just simpler than going to war. Not that doesn't mean it's cheaper, but it's simpler. By 1801, Jefferson took office, he had had enough. Harper's slogan was revived. Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. People get tired of paying blackmail. Of course, there's nothing in the world ever changes. We've been dealing now for the last 20 years or so with the exact same threat from Muslim pirates off the coast of Somalia in the Indian Ocean. Same thing, same people, same demand. We capture your ship, you pay money, we release your ship, and that's how we make a living. After Jefferson's inauguration, the Pasha of Tripoli sent greetings to the new president and asked for a payment of $225,000. Jefferson refused, and Tripoli declared war on the United States. Well, Jefferson dispatched a U.S. naval fleet under the command of Commodore Richard Dale in 1801 with orders to sink any enemy vessel in the Mediterranean. They first sank a pirate ship in August the 1st, and Jefferson wrote, "Too long have these barbarians been suffered to trample on the sacred faith of treaties, on the rights and laws of human nature." Barbarians indeed. The war dragged on. In 1803 was the first defeat, so to speak. An American ship, the Philadelphia, was captured, its crew held as hostages. Meanwhile, Jefferson was trying to do what today we call regime change, trying to overthrow the Pasha in Tripoli and replace him with his more amenable younger brother. But in a daring mission, the Marines, led by Stephen Decatur, Decatur, Illinois, etc., the Marines recaptured the Philadelphia and set the ship on fire. The Arabs were using it, it was a gunship, to fire on the American Navy. They captured the ship, set it on fire, and they soon captured the town of Derna, the first town on foreign soil on which the American flag was ever raised. And that's, of course, in the Marine hymn, "From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli." These are the shores of Tripoli where that took place. In 1805, the Pasha of Tripoli, already battered, sued for peace in exchange for $60,000, which they called ransom, not tribute. All Americans held hostage were released. Jefferson paid the money. Some Americans, including Americans on the ground of the military, were incensed he would pay it. But Jefferson knows the difference between ransom and blackmail. All right, it's a subtle difference. There's a difference. From then on, for at least a decade, American shipping was safe from Arab attack. It was America's first, but not last, foray into the Middle East. Among the distinguished fighters of the Marines then was one Joseph Israel. But no one knows whether he was Jewish or not. All right, sounds Jewish. This ended what's called the first Barbary Pirates War, the Barbary States War. There'd be a second war in 1815. Jefferson's main contribution to our subject is on religious affairs that ensured that America would treat its Jews and other religious minorities with equal rights. Now, again, nothing should be taken for granted. Jefferson was raised in a Virginia that, where it was a crime at the time in Virginia not to baptize infants into the Anglican faith. It's a crime. You went to jail for it. In fact, Jefferson said he recalls a child, a Baptist preacher, sending his sermons from prison, lo aleinu, because he was arrested for preaching doctrine against what the Anglicans said. Well, Jefferson was against any type of compulsion in spiritual matters. In 1786, he wrote into Virginia law a religious freedom bill. He was the author of it. That included, I quote, "within the mantle of its protection, the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mahometan, the Hindu," spelled with two O's, "and infidel of every denomination," end quote. And this was an inspiration for state laws everywhere. And this sentiment is reiterated in letters to individual Jews who had written to Jefferson. And this sentiment is enshrined in a phrase that Jefferson introduced into America's political lexicon that's taken on a life of its own and been somewhat distorted in the process. In October 1801, just 8 months after, 7 months after Jefferson took office, the Danbury Baptist Association wrote to Jefferson thanking him for his support for religious liberty. And Jefferson responded in early 1802, eloquently as always, that he believes religion to be a matter, he said, which lies solely between man and his God, that he owed account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions. And then he said the Constitution mandated that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, quote, "thus building a wall of separation between church and state," unquote. That phrase was Jefferson's, and it's not in the Constitution, as many people think, because the Supreme Court has cited that phrase so frequently, but it was what his interpretation of what the Bill of Rights meant. It's been distorted to mean that any government entanglement with religion is thereby prohibited, but that, of course, could not have been his intention. Obviously, school prayer, Christian school prayer, existed in his time, as did Bible study in public schools. You know, the modern irony is that schools today can promote all types of secularism and perversions, but the only taboo is religion. So that's strange, and part of the cultural wars today. The thickness of that wall of separation continues to be debated. I mean, American currency has on God We Trust, and Congress and the military have chaplains paid for by the government, and the president takes his oath of office on a Bible, as did Jefferson, and all these things offend the secularists. But in truth, that wall has helped Jews in America to a great extent, not completely, but to a great extent, and it certainly then increased the comfort level of the small American Jewish community during Jefferson's presidency. On balance, the wall of separation now is promoting too much secularism in American society, but there's no doubt that Jews benefited in the last 200 plus years from the fact that such a wall existed and did not precluded the government from intruding into our lives. In summary, Adams and Jefferson were different personalities who each contributed remarkably to American independence. They were strong advocates of religious liberty, and both having been burned, very cautious about government excess. So it's an irony. Adams was accused of being a monarchist and a federalist. Adams said, "There is danger from all men." A lot of women feel that way, by the way. "There is danger from all men. The only maxim of a free government ought to be to trust no man living with power to endanger the public liberty." And all the safeguards in the Constitution, all the checks and balances, and all the provisions of the Bill of Rights are designed to ensure that the Constitution does not encroach on our individual liberties. Each lived many years after serving as president. Each lived into ripe old age. Jefferson then, after retirement, built, and I mean literally built, the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He did the architecture also, laid out the grounds, did everything. In fact, his tombstone in Charlottesville, in Monticello actually, outside Charlottesville, his tombstone mentions only that he was the founder of the University of Virginia and the author of the Declaration of Independence. He did not feel the presidency was worth mentioning on his tombstone, as it was not the major achievement of his life. These two adversaries reconciled, and they began a voluminous correspondence on almost every topic under the sun, especially politics and history, religion and philosophy. There's a book came out not long ago called The Correspondence of Adams and Jefferson. And one of the greatest and most eerie coincidences in American history, both men fell deathly ill as the 50th anniversary of independence neared. And indeed, both men died on July 4th, 1826, exactly 50 years after the Declaration of Independence. Same day, Adams' son John Quincy was then the president. Told it was July 4th, early in the morning, Jefferson said, "It is a great day. It is a good day." And Adams' last words were, "Thomas Jefferson survives." But he was wrong. Jefferson had died 5 hours earlier. But in fact, Jefferson did survive, as did Adams. Their life's work and the values they instilled in the American Republic still endure until today. Next week, we'll discuss James Madison, maybe James Monroe also, and we'll look at some of the biblical and Torah influences on the Constitution. As you know, Madison is known as the father of the Constitution, so on what was much of their theory based. All that next week. I thank you all for coming.